Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The numbers that describe the flooding in Pakistan are staggering. A fifth of the country hit, 20 million people. A sheet of water covering the country's breadbasket, and more hunger and desperation and frustration. Here's one man in the Swat Valley with a now precious sack of rice on his shoulder.
It takes several hours to come from our village in the mountains. I spent all my savings on this food. No safe roads to walk on. No aid has arrived.
No aid has arrived. There is some, but not enough. And behind the suffering, sharp volatility. This hour, On Point, humanitarian crisis, pain, and politics in the floods of Pakistan. You can join the conversation. Can you believe the scale of this thing? What's the best response? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Islamabad in Pakistan is Zaid Hussain, reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Zaid, thank you very much for being with us. What's the latest news?
Well, I think the flood which had started 2 weeks ago from the northern Pakistan had spread to a vast area in south and western areas too. So more than 20 million people are not directly or indirectly affected. And one-third of the country, which is as big as Italy or even Britain, have been inundated or have come underwater. So it's a huge, is going to have a huge social, political, and economic cost to this country. We've never seen this kind of calamity ever in the history of this country. So it has not yet over, and more people are being affected now. And it's said that the figure of 20 million could rise to about 25 million people.
What is the situation now? What's the situation now with hunger? We've seen people having a lot of difficulty getting to food or getting food to people. What can you tell us about that?
Well, this is a major problem because the enormity of the problem is such a vast area has been affected that for any government or for any administration, it would have been difficult to feed all those people who are in need for need at this point. It's not just only food. We are only almost 900,000 people need to be fed every day. And apart from that, they also need safe drinking water because this is one of the major problems here because the rivers are swollen and people are drinking for survival from those contaminated water, which has created a huge health problem here too. So at this point, actually, what people, 900,000 people have to fed daily as well as provided with the safe drinking water.
There have been reports of cholera, certainly fear of cholera. What do you hear on that front, Zaid?
Well, there have been many cases of diarrhea, I would say, but very few cases of cholera yet. But there is a threat of cholera outbreak. The UN has been warning about this, and particularly about 3.5 million children are at huge risk. Actually, given the situation, if people do not get clean drinking water, then there is a real threat of cholera outbreak here in this country.
What's the sense of relief efforts at this point? How effective is the Pakistani government being, the Pakistani military? Is foreign aid arriving in a noticeable volume? And what about the Taliban? We hear in the United States that they're also joining in relief efforts with their own agenda.
Well, first we have to see the enormity of the problem. It is a massive problem. As I've said earlier, that a vast area of one-third of the country is underwater or has been affected by this flooding. So for the administration, it would have been very, very difficult. But given saying that, the administration has also been very, very slow. There has not been a coordinated effort yet. The federal government particularly have been accused of being insensitive, being very slow, and also not been have any coordinated effort. The military is on the ground. There are about 60,000 soldiers are on duty, flood duty. But they're still, actually, they're short of helicopters and other stuff. So whatever efforts are being made is inadequate at this point. There are international aid organizations in the field, but again, actually, there also their scarcity of resources have also affected their operation. The international community has responded very slow and too late now. Very little money has come from the international donors, and that has been the major cause of concern here.
We've seen on American television 19 American military helicopters doing rescue work. Are Pakistanis seeing that? Do they care? Does that seem like something significant or tiny?
Well, actually, it's a major effort by the U.S. Not only that, they have sent helicopters, but their $76 million have also been given for the flood relief. But actually, this enormity of problem is such that it needs much more resources than just this $76 million or 19 or 20 helicopters. There's need that other countries should also reciprocate or should also come forward to aid this. As far as you said about Taliban, I don't think Taliban can gain much ground here at this point. There has been some reports of some militant organization undercover have been involved in the relief work, but they have not been directly involved with the Taliban. As such, actually, if you look at the area, I have visited some of the worst hit areas,
yes,
which were once actually Taliban stronghold. But people are much more concerned about their daily life now than anything else. But yes, actually, I would say that what happens later on, in the aftermath of this flood, if the government does not actually respond strongly to the people's requirement, then there is always a fear that the situation could fuel extremism.
We will look at that. Zahid Hussain, reporter with the Wall Street Journal there in Islamabad. We're very grateful to you for your time. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Joining me now in the studio is Adil Najam, professor of international relations, geography, and the environment at Boston University. He's director of the Pardee Center there. He's been part of Pakistan's climate change delegation at the United Nations. Adil Najam, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you.
Enormity, the word we're hearing there from Zahid Hussain in Islamabad. It is hard to get our minds around the sheer scale of what's going on. Help us.
It's impossible to get your head around it. Every morning, the enormity changes, and every morning, you know, you wake up, you look at the numbers, and you say, this cannot possibly be so. 20 million. What is 20 million people? 20 million is more people than all of Sri Lanka, more people than all of Switzerland.
Out of their homes, on the move, many cut off from food,
right,
clean water.
Right. That's more people than 150 countries in the world. And all and that's just not the only number. It's 6 million without food. It's 3.5 million children in threat of serious health disease.
And mile after mile after mile after mile of cropland underwater, maybe not even plantable for the next season.
Exactly. And what you see is, you know, these pictures sometimes look eerily beautiful. It's just water. It looks
shimmering,
like a wonderful lake, but it's not a lake.
Mm-hmm.
Those were fields. Those were villages. Entire villages. You know, when you see flood pictures, you usually expect a house standing. Well, it now looks totally like a lake. But here is the issue. The real numbers will rise in 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, when actually the water dries up. That's when the disease hits. That's when the devastation hits. That's when the livelihoods are totally lost. The people go back to these fields and there's nothing. So this is really an ongoing crisis where what we are seeing is really the front edge of this flood. And once the waters have receded, everything rises again.
UN spokesman, they're describing it as worse than Haiti, though it doesn't happen all at once as in an earthquake. Never mind climate for a moment. Can you just describe to us meteorologically what has happened here? There's always a monsoon in Pakistan, but this year, and the monsoon comes up from the south, but the floods are coming from the north. What's happened?
So rain causes the natural disaster, and then humans cause the calamity. And what I mean by that is the rains come and hit. Usually the monsoons will come into the plains. And they'll also come up north, but what mm-hmm. happened this year was they hit the north much more. Now, the north in Pakistan means the edge of
mountains.
The Himalayas.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the clouds hit the Himalayas, the water comes bursting down, and that's where it accumulates. And then as it comes south, it just cascades and cascades, and it's bringing with it this massive debris.
In the Indus and the other rivers
coming in the Indus. And the reason the numbers keep rising is as you come south, you're coming more to the population centers. Mm-hmm. As you come south, you're coming to the economic centers. And what I meant by people cause the calamity is part of it is maldevelopment. Part of it is bad urban planning. So nature would have taken mm-hmm. its course mm-hmm. and certainly would have caused damage. Mm-hmm. But the scale we are seeing is a development disaster, not just a natural disaster.
There is a humanitarian crisis right in front of us here. Are we going to see a political crisis as well? There was outrage at the Pakistani president being off in Europe, swanning around while people suffered and died.
I hope not, but that's really what everyone in Pakistan is also talking about. And many people in Pakistan have forgotten, but they shouldn't. You know, back in 1970, November 1970, something called Cyclone Bhola hit a place called East Pakistan. This was November 12th of 1970. December 1971, East Pakistan turned into Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. Now, that wasn't just because of the cyclone. That cyclone took 500,000 people dead, 500,000 people. Mm-hmm. Now, it wasn't just because of the cyclone, but what happened after the cyclone was people just revolted against the apathy and mismanagement of the relief aid.
And a map redrawn politics over time.
You know, that led to one thing, led to the other. So people are again clamoring against apathy and mismanagement.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the epic flooding in Pakistan, looking at the urgent crisis there and its long-term implications. The sound of flood survivors behind me blocking a highway in protest of the slow delivery of aid. Here in Punjab province, worst hit in the flood so far, or one of the worst hit, one villager outraged that the government had not been providing more aid to the people there.
Our town is submerged in floods. At least 200 houses are inundated. The administration personnel are giving out aid to their own people. We are dying of hunger here. No one has showed up to comfort us.
And here's the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon saying he's never before seen a disaster as bad as the flooding in Pakistan. This from the state-owned broadcaster PTV.
I have visited scenes of many natural resources and natural disasters around the world. But nothing like this. The scale of this disaster is so large, so many people in so many places, in so much need.
A scale difficult to take on board. Adil Najam is with us from Boston University. He's also worked on the climate change, Pakistan's climate change delegation to the UN. Let's go back to Pakistan for just a moment. From Islamabad again, Shadana Khan joins us. She is CEO of Rural Support Programs Network. It's the largest network of development and relief agencies working in Pakistan. 77 of its district offices have been affected by the flooding. Shadana Khan, thank you very much for joining us. What are you hearing from your offices around the country?
Thank you. Hello. Unfortunately, there's no less in the rain. And, you know, as it rains in the north, it's still raining. You know, the flood keeps moving down and affecting the north also. Usually when a disaster strikes, and we've seen this before when we had a very bad earthquake about 5 years ago, and we had an IDP's crisis when there was a military operation in the north in a place called Swat, there's very little coordination, although in some areas it's better than it was before, between the various actors. And I think, to be fair, this crisis is so large that government and other efforts all put together, it will take a while for everyone to reach people affected.
Shadana, what's your sense now? Is the biggest problem getting relief aid into Pakistan, or, you know, the world contributing, or is the biggest problem getting relief to Pakistanis in the field where the flood is?
I think as of yesterday, I have not been updated on what's coming in. But even when it comes in, I think the processes of bureaucracy are so lengthy that the work is just not fast enough. We as local NGOs are sitting in the field at the grassroots. Our processes are perhaps quicker. But whatever has come in, I don't think that we see the impact of it out there as yet.
The death toll in this crisis, while large, up over 1,000, 1,500, you know, still one fears in a country the size of Pakistan could be worse. What are you expecting? What are you anticipating in terms of actual deaths here?
I don't think I can give you a number, but I think that it's not very hopeful because, you know, there is going to be now waterborne disease, and we are not getting out, able to get out medical teams fast enough, plus, you know, things like water purification tablets and things. And I think that the disease is probably going to hit us next and probably in a fairly big way.
Shadana Khan, we wish you good luck with all of your work there. We appreciate you being with us today. Let me just give Adil, who's sitting here with me, a chance to say hello. I know you two know each other.
Keep doing the good work you guys are doing there.
Shadana Khan with Rural Support Program Network in Islamabad, thank you very much for joining us. Almost all the bridges in the Swat Valley in the north washed away, cutting off villages and supplies, dividing families. Here's a man speaking to Al Jazeera yesterday as he waded next to a swollen river.
Our other kids have been stuck on the other side for about 10 days. I've been waiting in the rain with the rest of my family for about 2 hours. There are no roads or bridges. People's land, fields, homes are all destroyed. Even my cornfield washed away.
All destroyed. Cornfield washed away. Let's go to our listener, Sultan, in Windham, New Hampshire. Sultan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well.
I have two messages I want to... one is to the country political leadership, another is for the rest of the world. The political leadership, you know, is completely ineffective. The president is taking care of his real estate holding in Europe, and that doesn't give a very good message to the public, to the masses. And the corruption is so believed that people really do not want to send the money to the government because this is an overreach, so they are looking for NGOs. But what a shame. The absolute distrust of the government. So the theory is they should understand that the rain and the flood have destroyed the houses, but their ineffectiveness will destroy their political dynasties too, you know, in a due time then. And to the world, is Pakistan is one of the largest countries in the world, politically very, very important, and the response from the world is so poor, it's unbelievable, especially from Arab countries, which they claim they're a Muslim brotherhood and all that, and have very, very meager, you know, support from them, either in material-wise. Where are the Saudi helicopters? Why can't they loan the Egyptians or Syrian or others? And then there's the month of Ramadan. They claim this is a charity and this is a month of giving and all that, but it's all talk. And this is where then these, you know, radical people come into picture. They say, yeah, these are the people who's presenting Islam. And, you know, when it's such a serious crisis and they are having a fun and lavish living and they cannot even afford some support to their brothers who are dying every day in the sun. So I think it's in both ways, it's going to be a very bad omen for the future of, you know, for the powerful and in Pakistan or in the rest of the world, specifically Muslim leadership. In the world.
Sultan, I appreciate your call very much. Where are the Saudi helicopters, Sultan? Says Adil, what about on the domestic front, on the international front?
Everyone needs to do more. I mean, I think there's a little unfairness in the comment in the sense that...
I read Saudis this morning are opening their pocket. I don't know the scale.
Yeah, the single largest contribution yet is by the U.S., which is 76.5 million. The second largest is by the Saudis, which is about 45 million. The OIC, the Organization of Islamic Countries, has given 24. But I think what the caller puts his finger on is the sense of unease and apathy, really, the sense that, you know, we have no control over this. But here is the real number. The US, so the estimate of what it will take to rebuild is $15 billion.
We're not even in the ballpark.
By the way, that's the Kerry Lugar bill. But let's keep that number in mind. So need $15 billion. UN says appeal for $460 million.
And they've got maybe half of that or something?
Pledged. Two-thirds of that.
Okay, good.
Paid one-third of that.
Okay.
Right? Here is the helicopter business. We've already talked about 20 million people, size of England.
Mm-hmm.
Total number of helicopters available in Pakistan for relief efforts today, 67.
And the U.S. sent in 19. That's US, about one
which,
per million.
You know, everyone counts.
Yeah.
Those helicopters
yeah,
are
yeah,
really
yeah.
One, because most of these people you can't get to. It's not just that you don't have the clean water. How do you get the clean water to them? So just imagine 20 million people, 67 helicopters, 917 boats as of yesterday. That is the scale, not just of the calamity.
The mismatch.
Exactly.
It is hard to apprehend how something like that resolves itself. Let me get a call from Linda in Nashville, Tennessee. Linda, you're on the air.
Hi. I was in East Pakistan during the disaster in 1970 and then actually evacuated in December to West Pakistan.
So East Pakistan, that is before it broke away to be Bangladesh, as we know it, of course.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And was still in Bangladesh during that incredibly awful disaster. I remember clearly, even though I was a teenager, that as we were trying to evacuate the added disaster of the war, going over makeshift bridges or taking ferries to try to find another portion of the road to travel on.
Many Americans contributed back in that day. People of a certain age remember the concert for Bangladesh, all that, yes.
Right, but there were dozens of bodies and animals mm-hmm. floating all around the cars as we tried to make it through to one of the major cities.
And now, this time, Linda, what do you see this time? We're seeing 200,000 head of livestock at least already lost here.
Exactly. I mean, it being worse than that time in Bangladesh, I can only imagine what a devastation it could be. And yes, the Americans did provide a great deal of financial support and all, but the financial devastation was so great that many of those things that were contributed, a lot of the things for aid that was contributed ended up on the black market, people just trying to survive and unable to get, not only because of a poor infrastructure or transportation infrastructure in the country, but even if there were a better infrastructure, it would have been flooded. It just was nothing.
Always the danger in a crisis. Linda, I appreciate your call and your reference to the history, same history that Adil Najam you're thinking of now, and the political turmoil that came after.
Very, very quickly, if I might, you know, in some ways the government is getting a bad rap, but that doesn't matter. The question
is, a bad rap from Pakistanis.
Pakistanis itself, from the international. I mean, there isn't, you know, that much you can do at that point, but they're getting a bad rap because their reputation is so low and they need to do something about it. For, you know, Americans to understand, you remember when Katrina happened,
mm-hmm.
and I forget the name of the gentleman who headed FEMA at that point, and he became, you know, the
symbol. You're doing a heck of a job, Brownie.
Exactly. And here you have a country where the country is looking at all of the government as if it was Brownie.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the sense. And when you have that disconnect, what happens is that the social forces that should be mobilized into action don't want to give to government. And that is very
suspicious.
You know, I'll tell you my biggest fear. The flood has already destroyed everything in its wake. And I fear, and I really hope I'm wrong, I really, really hope I'm wrong, but there's a real fear that it will destroy our fledgling democracy, too.
What does that mean? Military stepping in?
Unfortunately,
Taliban stepping in?
I think Taliban is a much further cry, but mm-hmm. there are people who are beginning to talk about the military because the military is one of the institutions that seem to be doing good. I hope the military doesn't want to do that, and I hope people understand that that's not the way to go.
Let's go back to Pakistan. There's nothing like hearing straight from the country. Musharraf Zaidi joins us, columnist for The News, Pakistan's biggest English language daily newspaper. Musharraf Zaidi, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us. What are you seeing there?
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you again.
What are you seeing? What's your concern? You're writing about a hyperactive cocktail now in Pakistan. Certainly wet, but where the volatility you're writing about, where's it come from?
Well, it's coming from a sense of confusion and a sense of desperation. And this confusion and desperation is being fed into and being stimulated by a news media that, you know, that's still in its sort of first generation. It's still learning the ropes of what it means to be a responsible media and what its limitations might be. So I think that a lot of what you just touched, the fear that Adam just articulated about the democracy in this country, I think that's the hyperactivity is whether or not people can be reasonable about this country, both within Pakistan, Pakistanis themselves, and people watching Pakistan closely out there in Massachusetts or, you know, in the United States, you know, this flood and the catastrophe that has ensued is not a single-day event. It's now going into almost 3 weeks of wave after wave of flooding. If you see pictures of what's happened in southern Punjab, where a river that was less than a mile wide has now the width of, at some parts, 18 miles.
Wow.
So the Indus River, which at these points is less than a mile wide, is now 18 miles wide. There is no government in the world, there is no state in the world, there is no military in the world that could have dealt with this in any way. I mean, this is just it's nature at its worst. Of course, there's been a problem with the messaging from this government and the foreign trips that the president took. But really, the obsession of a lot of folks, both within Pakistan and outside Pakistan, in terms of blaming the government for not dealing with this flood, I think it comes from a very limited understanding of what this flood represents.
Let me ask you, Musharraf, you've written that President Zardari seems, quoting you, seems totally detached from reality. You say, what idiot would mistake the president for his wife, that is the assassinated Benazir Bhutto? You write, those expecting Churchillian timing or Obama-esque rhetoric, you know, should pause. I mean, they can't be serious. What about the leadership you are getting, Musharraf?
It's pretty slim and it's limited. But then again, this is a very young country, and our democracy has been limited over the years, both because of our own intolerance and impatience for mistakes, and because the world has always seemed to need Pakistan for one task or another. And so the combination of our own problems compounded by the neighborhood that we're located in means that democracy never really gets a chance. We'll only be able to develop those kinds of leaders, Tom, the leaders that I talked about, the Winston Churchills and the Barack Obamas, once we have a chance to develop this democracy, once people have a chance to reject at the election leaders like President Zardari and select different people next time. But we never get that chance. We never get to complete a government. We never get a chance to see out a government and reject people who've already had a chance and bring in new people. Instead, all the kinds of pressures that I've just mentioned, external and internal, end up creating a momentum for military governments, and I think that's very dangerous.
Do you feel that momentum right now? Adil Najam voices the concern on many people's mind. What about the stability of Pakistan's democracy?
I think it's a concern, but I have to be honest with you. It's a concern that's way, way, way at the back of my mind. The primary concern that I have, after having visited some of the flood-affected areas and having been part of, you know, some of the flood relief activities,
yes,
here in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, my primary concern is how these people that don't have access to food or water or medicine, that don't have shelter and that don't have electricity, how those folks are going to get those things that they need to survive. And that's the concern, I think, for most Pakistanis who have a good handle on what's going on. You had Chandana Khan on before. Her organization, the group of organizations that she works with, the RSPs, are doing a phenomenal job. International NGOs are doing an unbelievable job. The Red Cross, the Red Crescent, Oxfam, Save the Children, Islamic Relief. There's a whole momentum of both domestic Pakistani and international NGOs that are stepping up. But unless people begin to finance these organizations much more generously than they have so far, it's going to be very difficult to reach each and every person that's been affected by this.
Musharraf Zaidi, columnist for The News in Islamabad, thank you very much for being with us. You're quite right. Relief, the number one issue right now. You can find ways to contribute at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about the epic flooding in Pakistan, looking at the urgent crisis there and its longer-term implications. Here in London on Monday is UN Goodwill Ambassador Angelina Jolie championing support for Pakistan's flood victims.
This is going to be something that goes on for a very, very long time. They're going to be displaced for a long time. The cholera outbreak could be very serious. So many children could die. It's one of those that we can't really just donate and contain. It's a very, very big one, and I myself don't know how to quite help to tackle it yet, but just keep asking questions and do what you can.
Adil Najam joined us, Professor of International Relations, Geography and the Environment at Boston University. You're welcome to join us as well. Adil, here's a comment from our website, onpointradio.org. Hassan says, for a predominantly agrarian economy, it's a death call. Pakistan's already been on the brink with its war on terror on the northern front, the wave of violence, suicide bombings, problems of democracy. This country is at the crossroads, everything happening at the same time. He writes, history is on steroids here. He goes on to say it's also a historical opportunity for the U.S. to turn around its relationship with this region. Adil, really?
Well, first, the agriculture point is exactly right, and we missed that. You know, what else is on the banks of the index? The entire economy of Pakistan. The region, this economy, the reason this mm-hmm. economy survives is because of the Indus. Now, I think there is a rebuilding opportunity. I'll come to the U.S. Mm-hmm. in a minute, but there's also a rebuilding opportunity for Pakistan. In some ways, you know, people have been starting talking in Pakistan about a Marshall Plan. This is not about the aid. You know, when we think of the Marshall Plan, we think of, you know, us in the U.S. giving a lot of support to mm-hmm. someone. But the Marshall Plan was also an idea that you could take a place that is totally devastated and build it anew on better foundations. That's the opportunity that could be there for Pakistan. And if Pakistanis see the U.S., as being honest in wanting to help that. No, it's not a question of how much money. It's a question of wanting to help that. Then it will work. Now, frankly speaking, a lot of Pakistanis don't believe that. The honest truth is, and we've talked about this mm-hmm. on this show before, the Americans do not trust Pakistan. And Pakistanis do not trust America.
That's not exactly a formula for holding hands and bright future.
Exactly, but if we start from that realization and say that is what we need to change, here is an opportunity, much more than drones and much more than the war on terror. You know, we keep talking about winning hearts and minds.
Yeah.
You know how you win hearts and minds? Through the stomach.
But the need is now so enormous. It was bad enough before. Here on the other side of the border, Americans are getting weary of the expenditures in Afghanistan. The UN is battling donor fatigue. You pointed it out yourself. In fact, where do the resources come from to make a serious... Pakistanis are smart. They know what's a serious effort at a
sure.
Marshall Plan and what's not.
Sure. Two silver linings here in a very dark cloud. First, yes, the needs are greater. But whatever it will take to rebuild is far, far less than whatever we are already spending on the aggressive side of fighting wars. Winning a reconstruction is cheaper than fighting a war that we haven't been winning. So that's thing one. Second, we know how to do this. We don't know how to fight insurgents. We know how to build dams. We know how to build mm-hmm. houses. We know how to give water to people. So here is something that we know how to do, which is very different from the whole war on terror.
Does Pakistan still have the credit? Kind of the moral credit in the bank with the global community. I mean, it's been
a big question.
I hope so, but
big question.
It's been a trouble spot for a long time.
Big question. But let's also be honest. Does the international community have the credit within the Pakistani people? Because the image of the ship coming in the sky
yep.
is not just of the helicopter. It's also of the drone.
And the missile and the death. AK in Boston. AK, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have a question regarding, you know, the state of the international NGO organizations on the ground with all the bad news in the past about, you know, people getting shot and executed and, you know, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that the network, the Western NGO network, is not as deep as it could have been, and that is hampering the distribution of aid? And also, the WikiLeaks article about, you know, the fact that, you know, ISI being involved in all of these issues, has it caused fatigue among Western governments with respect to aid to Pakistan?
Interesting questions, yeah. Both, AK.
So on the first one, I think sort of, again, the good news in some ways is that the actual infrastructure of international relief is quite deep in Pakistan. Because of the war on terror, because of the Swat IDP crisis, because of the earthquake, all the big players have been there. So they have been quite quick to mobilize.
They know the terrain.
Right. They know the terrain. They have the people.
In spite of the risks and the unsettled circumstances.
Yeah. But all of them have permanent offices there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this this okay. is unusual and this so it so yeah. it has been mobilized quickly. Yeah. The money hasn't been mobilized, but the people have. Mm. The WikiLeaks thing, I think, is important. I think that's what I meant, you know, whether the international
this with
community.
All the memos from the ground of people, yeah. Americans in Pakistan, military and others saying yeah. the Pakistani intelligence service is making
and,
problems
yeah,
for
and
us.
I think sort of we have done a disservice to ourselves and to this country. That's what Musharraf meant when he said, can we think reasonably about this country?
Pakistan.
About, I think internationally we have become so used to just blaming Pakistan mm-hmm. for everything. You know, I'm just waiting for the call that will say Hamid Gul and the Lashkar-e-Tayyiba did this. We have gotten so used to, we've created a rhetoric of such anguish about this country mm-hmm. that we are not seeing the possibility. That could. So I think that rhetoric also needs to change. Very, very quickly, mm-hmm, if I might, mm-hmm. Liz Doucette, who is the BBC correspondent,
yes, of course.
One of the most informed and best foreign
She's
correspondent.
She's filled
in
for me right here.
Yep.
Bless her.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And on her Twitter account yesterday, mm-hmm, on her mm-hmm. tweet, she tweeted this in 140, you know, she mm-hmm. 140, characters, yeah, 140 characters.
Yeah, yeah.
She quoted this official and caught the desperation in the voice, and she said, the official she quoted was saying that in 2005 with the earthquake, 3 million people displaced, 1 million tents distributed.
Mm-hmm.
Today, 20 million people displaced, 100,000 tents distributed.
Not even close.
You know, we talk
Two
about the Taliban.
From Pakistan.
If the Taliban make inroads on this, it is not because of what they will do. If they make inroads, it is because of what we do not do.
Let's get a call from Iowa City, Iowa, if we can. Rick, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello.
Hi.
The first part is a kind of a technical question that I don't know about. I was wondering how much weight that the normal drones could carry, and if they could carry enough to be of any help, if they could employ all of the drones to start dropping supplies in areas where they could be got reached by the Pakistani people.
It's a lovely idea, but it may be sort of, you know, Lucy in the sky with diamonds. I mean, they call them predators for a reason. I don't know if they have that kind of but it's a good question. You know, could they carry in rice instead of just video cameras and bombs? And your other, Rick?
Well, if they could, then that would help dispel part of the idea that they're merely killing machines and that they can actually be helped in a human crisis like this.
Or maybe to be used to guide aid to where it's most needed. Rick, thanks. Adil, I don't know how much...
I don't know about the drones, but when the earthquake happens, one of the best things that the U.S. did was, and because Afghanistan was next door, immediately a lot of the Chinooks that were being mm-hmm. used for military
Heavy
operations...
Heavy lift helicopters.
Those are the single most useful things right now.
Bulk
they can,
delivery.
They can move yep. a large number of people. They can move large amounts of goods.
Mm-hmm.
That's the image you want. Again, you want the image of good things falling from the sky.
Not necessarily bombs. Not now. Eric in Norfolk, Massachusetts. Eric, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a huge fan. With my limited knowledge of the area, I couldn't agree more with your guest today.
Adil.
Mm-hmm. And that we seem to sort of mess up the end game, as they put it in Charlie Wilson's War. We're not helping, and this seems like a great opportunity we could do a lot more and help in this area.
So step up. Do it this time. Good opportunity, you say. Eric, I appreciate your call. Let me get another here from Sarah in Belmont. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say something that nowhere have I heard any mention of global warming and causing, which must be playing a major part in causing this kind of flooding, because this is completely unprecedented, because flooding happens in the eastern part of the subcontinent, but not like this, in this part. And things like the Swat Valley, I mean, they're like snow-capped mountains and things like that. So nobody ever talks about this, and people are just talking about it as if this is a routine thing. This is not routine at all. This is unprecedented, and the rainfall has been like 10 times what it usually is. So why is this? Why isn't this discussed in detail?
It's a great question. We'll pick it straight up, Sarah. I mean, Adil, you've got some experience on the climate change front with the UN. I am looking here at, I mean, if you pull the lens back a little bit, you've got this
China.
Flooding in China,
yeah.
Which has had a big death toll there, and you've got the flooding in Pakistan. You've got the crazy fires just to the north
yeah.
in Russia, the UN. You know, here I'm looking at Omar Badur, Chief of Climate Data Management with the UN World Meteorological Organization, saying we will always have climate extremes, but it looks like climate change is exacerbating the intensity of the extremes. Says he can't point at any individual thing.
I talk about climate change all the time. That's what I do for a living. I study global warming and climate change. Now, the fact of the matter is you cannot put a direct fingerprint on this and say this is because of climate change. At the same time, we know that climate change exacerbates. It doesn't cause problems. It exacerbates them. It makes them bigger. It makes them more frequent. It makes them larger. So some part of this may be about it, but that's not just the point. I think what we learn about climate change is why it is so important for developing countries, because we depend so much on climate. We don't realize
the relationship with nature is direct. It's not intermediated.
That's where our livelihood, that's where our paychecks come from. And when you mess with nature, nature messes with you big time. That's the lesson. In some ways, that was the lesson of Katrina. Katrina wasn't because of climate change, but it reminded us of what it could do.
Well, and it's not only developing countries. I mean, ultimately, nature has the last word. I mean, but for everybody, I mean, the same UN organization is saying that this year is on track to be the warmest year since temperature records began in, the mid-19th century. Let's get another call on this front. We've got Bill in Ripton, Vermont. I think this is environmentalist author Bill McKibben. Bill, is that you?
Indeed it is. How are you, Tom?
Well, what do you see, Bill?
Look, two quick stories. We were talking 8 weeks ago with our 350.org crew in Pakistan. People in Pakistan don't normally complain about the heat because it's often hot. But they noted that was a hot day, and I said, how high? I said, well, someplace in Pakistan today, we just set the new all-time Asia temperature record at 129 degrees.
In Jacobabad, yeah.
You know, I can set my oven to 129 degrees pretty much. This is what the world is going to start to look like over and over and over again. The atmosphere, because warm air holds more water vapor than cold, is about 5% moister than it was 40 years ago. That's the precondition for the kind of record rainfall that triggers record flooding. So the job clearly right now is to provide aid and rescue people. But the other thing that the Western world has got to do is stop pouring that carbon into the atmosphere that's loading the dice for just this kind of outcome. The other story I'll tell you is, and it's for me very moving, in the last week at 350.org, as we're preparing for this huge global day, a global work party on energy on 10-10-10, October 10th, we're signing up thousands of actions all over the world, but in the last week, 10 different places in Pakistan, people have signed up actions in their communities, whether it's digging community gardens or putting up solar panels or doing kind of rescue work from the flooding in the name of trying to do something about this larger problem that's affecting every place on Earth. The thing to bear in mind is this is what the world looks like with 1 degree extra warmth. The climatologists tell us that unless we get on the stick right away, 4 or 5 degrees before centuries, and we are finally seeing at least a little taste of what this world looks like, and God, is it brutal.
Well, Nelly, bar the door, a big snapshot of context there and connections between, you name it, the greenhouse gases anywhere in the world and occurrences anywhere in the world. Bill McKibben, I appreciate your call. Adil, if we can just hold that, it's such a big issue and we acknowledge it fully. We've got a lot of callers here, though. I want to get a couple more. John, Fort Drum, New York. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. What's up? I hate to be criticizing on your guest there, but I just spent a year in Afghanistan, and, you know, the cultures there are very similar to Pakistan. One thing I noticed is whenever we gave all sorts of aid to these people, they just took complete advantage of it. I mean, stealing, you know, uniforms and supplies from school children, you know, taking food, taking money, you know, giving it to the wrong people, and just taking advantage of us in general. The other thing I have is the Predator drones. They cannot carry any type of supplies, unfortunately. They're not equipped to do that, and there's no way for them to haul any type of cargo.
John, I appreciate your service, and I appreciate your perspective there. Adil, you know, you're going to be up against some of that. I mean, it's been a tough road in Afghanistan. It's right next door. You hear Sergeant John.
That's what I meant. There is no trust between the two countries, and there's no trust between the two people. I mean, that's, you know, we keep talking about how Pakistanis feel about America. maybe we should start also talking about how Americans feel about Pakistan, if we really want a relationship. Tough as it may sound, here is what I would argue. If we are not moved by our compassion, if we think that these people are not worth helping, then don't. Let us not help them if it is only because we think there's some political strategic advantage, because we will waste our money and we will insult their intelligence. Mm. Look at the pictures, look at the reality. If the compassion moves you as a human being, not because they're Pakistani, not because they're Muslim,
look to
not
your moral
because
center, not your political compass.
If it moves your heart as a human, then do something.
And at the same time,
if not, then not.
I couldn't agree more. And again, directions to how you can help at our website, onpointradio.org. The context never goes away. Here's Ahmed Rashid. You know his writing. Well, he says, the next few months could be even worse. You could see the collapse of governance, growing desperation of flooded areas, leading to increased social ethnic tensions, terrible food shortages, the threat that large parts of the country now cut off from Islamabad will be taken over by Pakistani Taliban and extremist groups. Wow, I mean, it's kind of an apocalyptic scenario he's drawing.
Yeah, I have great respect for Ahmed, and I think his larger point is right, though I think the sort of point about sort of being taken over by Taliban, A, I hope it's wrong, B, I think it is wrong. I think his larger point is the right one. As I said, you know, 3 weeks into this, 4 weeks into this, the pictures of the water have gone away, and disease doesn't photograph well. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, water photographs well, yep. Disease doesn't.
Right.
The governance challenge has really exacerbated at that point, because now even if you have this aid, you have to distribute it. The ogre of corruption comes up. The ogre of bad governance comes up. So there becomes very serious political challenges to the polity. That's why I started with the example of Bhola. I don't think things are as bad as in the cyclone of 1970, but that is where it becomes a political crisis. I think, as I said, it's a political crisis, mm-hmm. B, it's a development crisis, mm-hmm. C, I think it is a development opportunity. Do we do it right this time?
And right now, a crisis of need for those without shelter, without food, at risk of disease. You can help. There are directions on how to do that at our website, onpointradio.org. Adil Najam of Boston University, it's always great to have you. Sorry to have you in such tough circumstances this time, but thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.